Welcome to Mysterious Universe Plus, Season 21, Episode 21. Coming up on the show, we've got the Button Man of Bunyip Forest, Bush Hermit Homebrew, and the UFO story banned from social media. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
Something weird is going on around the world, Ben. UFOs have returned to our skies across the globe. There's sightings happening in Brazil. There's strange activity that's occurring in Australia. There were strange unexplained booms going on in Canberra, of all places. Something very strange is going on.
Isn't that every week?
Well, it is.
There's stuff going on all the time.
This is different, though, because I must say, I'm a little bit cynical when it comes to lights in the sky. Now, we get plenty of emails from people saying, hey, guys, check out this light in the sky. And I just go, it's another light in the sky. You know, people don't really care.
But that's what I'm saying. We feel that way because it happens all the time.
Yes, but it's when the high strangeness and weirdness behind it starts to have some type of, influence upon the collective, where you start to go, oh, there's something very odd occurring here.
I'm more interested in these claims that the story's being removed from social media.
Yeah, this is very, very odd. So I actually, I saw this come up on social media a couple of weeks ago. It was around the 11th or 12th of May. And I saw that there was this hashtag that was trending, which was hashtag MargeUFO. And I clicked on it because, of course, anything like that comes up, part of my job, I check it. And there were all these strange claims and photographs of people claiming that UFO activity had been seen over the town of Marge in Brazil. It's about, I think, 40 miles north of Rio de Janeiro. And people were posting photographs and were talking about their experiences and what they'd seen. And apparently the town was going nuts. And in fact, there was a video that was put up by Linda Moulton Howe, which we'll go into in a moment. Yeah, of all places. Like Linda, she has been in contact with someone from Brazil who always provides her, apparently he's like kind of this Brazilian correspondent for her, who provides details about events that are occurring down there. And the video, which I'll link to in the show notes to Linda's Earth Files YouTube video that you can see for yourself, it's strange. I mean, it's hard to tell whether or not it could just be drones because the lighting in itself is odd. It's like, when you look at it, it's only about 40 or 50 seconds that you see in this video footage. But when the video footage opens up, all you can hear is sirens going crazy, because there's a whole heap of police that are around, so they were witnessing it, authorities were witnessing this. And the camera pans up to the sky, and you can see these 18 or so red lights that are moving in this strange fashion. And they're quite close to each other, and they kind of shrink into each other, and then they come out and expand, and then they spin around, and then go on their top, and then the camera pans away, and we don't know what happens after that. So at first, if I'd just seen that, I thought, oh, well, you know, that's strange lights in the sky, but
CGI.
Yes, CGI is a possibility. Well, Linda claims that there's far more to it, and someone has hacked a radio transmission of the military that was trying to deal with it on that very night, which might give us some insight as to why it was deleted from social media.
Is this Linda, Emmy award-winning documentary producer, Hal?
I know what you're going to say.
Or here. Linda, crazy, I believe everything, Hal?
Look, I think with Linda, and I know that I've had mixed feelings about her in the past. I mean, ultimately, I've got to say, every video I've noticed, she's a really snappy dresser.
Oh.
Like, every video she's in.
Snappy.
She's
always wearing high leather boots nice jacket.
She's really got style about her. But that's not important. What is important is that I think that, and this will come up in the audio that I want to play for you from Linda, I think Linda actually is a great researcher. I think the problem is that she gets led astray sometimes by a deliberate misinformation campaign. I think it's done on purpose. I think that she starts getting close to finding out answers, and then she's led down the garden path on purpose so that she looks like a lunatic and no one will actually take her seriously. But in this particular audio, I mean, it's kind of, we have to take it with a grain of salt, but Linda herself even says, look, she calls out to her viewers. She says, if you were there and you have the footage, send it to me because I'm going to send it to a video analysis, you know, person who I've worked with for years so we can try and work out what's really going on here. We need to find out more details about what the audio transcription is or what this detail is that comes from this allegedly hacked audio signal.
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to hearing the rest of the story, especially the claims that it's being actively banned.
Yeah.
I wanted to go into a story that was sent to me by Dick's Pizza on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
This is on Saturday morning, I think. Fantastic story. It's a local story. It's from John Sylvester. He's one of Australia's leading crime journalists. And he's started following this story of people going missing in the Victorian bushland. Basically, in northeast Victoria, there's an area called the High Country.
Yeah.
Right? It's just where there's, you know, tons of forest. And over the last, you know, 10 years or so, there's been, you could argue, an abnormal amount of people just vanishing.
You mean actually vanishing and their bodies are never found?
Just completely without a trace.
Right.
And the latest to go missing is a known drug dealer. So obviously there's stories surrounding him getting, you know, hit by a rival gang or something like that. This guy went missing in the area. But what's also intriguing is it's in Bunyip State Park where all these people have gone missing.
So what's in a name?
Yeah, so Bunyip, for those who don't know, it's an Aboriginal mythical creature. But I was doing more research today. I always thought that the name does apply to a water-based, you know, creature. It's kind of a swamp-dwelling cryptozoological creature.
But isn't it also sometimes referred to as the equivalent of a Bigfoot?
No, it's in the same ballpark in terms of it being cryptozoological. But when I was reading into the origin of the term, Bunyip or Bunyip in the local tribal language just means devil or spirit.
Ah, okay.
So it's basically called Devil's Canyon. Yep. And of course, David Politis had that book, The Devil's in the Details, going through all those places in the United States that have devil in the name. It's some kind of reference to the devil, Devil's Canyon and the like, people go missing.
Do you remember the Devil's Pool, which was that waterway up in Queensland or North Queensland where someone drowned there only recently? You know, this thing just keeps on happening. It seems like there's this negativity associated with the name.
But what got me into the story is there's this strange hermit that lives on the mountain in this wilderness area where the people have gone missing. He's called the Button Man. And there's all sorts of creepy tales about this guy. He's apparently in his 70s, but he moves through the forest like he was born in it. He moves through it like he's a tribesman from the Amazon. He will sneak up to experienced hunters and basically be breathing on the back of their neck, and they won't even know that he's crept up on them. There's all sorts of weird stories about this guy. So the crime writer, John Sylvester, he's loosely connecting this strange hermit known as the Button Man to these disappearances and openly asking if he's connected in some way. Does he know why people are going missing? What's going through his head? Why does he spend so much time up in the wilderness? So this kind of inspired me to go into stories of Australian hermits. I wanted to find more examples of famous Australian hermits, you know, the ones who ultimately return to society and have stories to tell. So I've got a bunch of stuff coming up on that as well. But I can't wait to hear the story. Let me know what's going on with this UFO.
Okay, well, let's hop into this. So Marjay actually began trending on Twitter on Wednesday morning, and several people just started, as I said, sharing these videos of glowing lights in the sky. Some of the videos are quite varied. So some of them show blue lights, others show yellow orbs. They're moving around the sky in this sort of cyclic fashion. In one of the videos, apparently, allegedly, it shows the lights appearing in a triangular kind of formation.
Can you link to the video in the show notes? Can we watch it?
No, I can't. Any of these videos I'm mentioning right now, I cannot find.
They're gone.
I cannot find them. The only video I have is the one from Linda Moulton Howe, which I described just a moment ago, and I will link to her video so you can see it on her channel.
So how did she get it?
So she got it because it was emailed to her from her Brazilian correspondent.
Gotcha.
So how he got it, I don't know. But when I looked at the footage, it's interesting because, as I was saying, it kind of looks a little bit like, I think it was Lady Gaga did the Super Bowl show years ago, and she had all the drones and the lights in the distance.
Okay.
It kind of has that kind of look to it. But Linda Moulton Howe asked this question. She's like, first of all, Brazil has a long history of strange UFO activity. There's a very long history of it. But why would somebody take the time and spend the money to put 18 drones over a suburb essentially of Rio to create this kind of effect? And why would you spend the time? Why would you spend the money? And it didn't look like it was something that was done by an amateur.
University project, maybe?
Could be a university project, but no, this is the thing as well. No one has come out. No one has said anything. No one's come forward to say, oh no, that was us doing this, or nothing like that has come out. But what is really strange is, as I said, you know, these videos have disappeared, but it's not only the videos. This hashtag started, and it was going for a little while, and then all of a sudden, it just vanished.
What was the hashtag?
The hashtag was hashtag Marjay UFO, and it's gone. There was another one I saw as well, which was Brazilian UFO crash. Gone. And what I mean gone, I mean there is no record of it at all.
So when you click on the tag in Twitter or you search for the tag, what do you get?
So occasionally you do get a couple of hits, but as big as it was and when it was trending, it was so much larger. It started trending yet again. Well, not trending, but it started being more popular because of the fact that it disappeared. It was like it was so conspicuous that it was gone that people started actually then questioning the conspiracy. And I think a Marjay conspiracy hashtag has now come up for how strange this is. But it wasn't just Twitter. It was also other social media giants. Things were disappearing off YouTube. The videos were actually disappearing off YouTube. Things were disappearing from Reddit. And in fact, I think in Reddit, it was posted in the UFO subreddit. And apparently a moderator came out and said, oh, look, there's a lot of stupidity in this thread and we don't delete anything. But if it's a hoax, we'll remove it. And then nothing. So it's like, well, how do you know it's a hoax?
So the mods just said it was a hoax.
Yeah, the mods just said it was a hoax and the whole thing's been scrubbed. But why? I mean, you would think if you're going to be talking about something like that, even if it's a hoax, you would leave it in there. Why would you get rid of it? So there's something...
Well, how can you tell if it's a hoax if you can't see the video?
Exactly. Exactly. So I thought, this is very strange. And I thought, well, maybe this is simply what it is. Maybe it is just simply it's been a hoax and it's been debunked. Or like you said, Ben, maybe someone's come out and said, oh, no.
Hang on a second. Stop. Let me just check Snopes.
It's been debunked, guys.
And I'll just see if it's been debunked.
So allegedly it hasn't. And what is great about this story is that there is this strange kind of follow-up to it that makes it unusual. Now, of course, as I said with Linda, I think she's a great researcher. I think she's done some great work, but she has at times been led down the garden path. And there's a possibility here that maybe her contacts have also been led down the garden path, because allegedly... she's gotten hold of the video, but before we, well, she's gotten hold of details, a transcript relating to the video. But before we do that, let's listen to Linda herself. And she describes why she thinks it's important that we talk about this, because she has such a huge amount of experience behind her. There's something to this, which is more than drones. Take a listen.
18 glowing lights that are doing motions in the sky that are not consistent with things that are astronomical, or perhaps not even consistent with organization of drones. But I think this was definitely worth going into and considering, because it made a tremendous amount of buzz. And one of the things that I have learned from all of my work is often when something is actually very real, and is captured, let's say on video or otherwise, by eyewitnesses, within 72 hours, you can almost count on it, comes in counter-intel with, it's a hoax, it's drones, it's this, it's that. And then 99% of the world goes away.
Now, I think that's really important. And I think coming from someone like Linda, who does have a wealth of experience behind her, I think something like that is very poignant. We need to listen to that. I mean, it's sad that that's the way that things happen. But yeah, I mean, it seems like whenever something strange is recorded, very rapidly there's this cynicism that approaches it.
I remember a UFO researcher talking about this, and it was intriguing to hear him describe it, because he was ex-FBI. And I think he had some kind of inside knowledge on how this was done. I'm trying to remember his name. I saw him at Contact in the Desert.
Right.
Yeah, he claimed there was this specific team that was, it's kind of like, you know, an online team for the NSA.
Yep.
And their task is to look for these videos. And if it's anything genuine that they feel is genuine, they'll just take it down. There's an active campaign to take it down.
Look, I believe that. I think there is something to that. And it's kind of strange though, because as I said, it's almost, it makes it more conspicuous. Because if something comes up and it's a hoax and it's proven to be a hoax, it seems like the video stays up. But if the video pops up or the photo pops up and people say, oh, it's a hoax, and then it disappears, well, you remove a person's ability to actually look at it and go, well, hang on a second, is that a hoax? Or, but it seems like maybe it's a psychological thing that people just immediately go and fill out Snopes and say, well, it's a hoax. It's a hoax.
He was saying it's mostly a smoke screen. So you're filling the internet with enough information on it being fake.
That people believe it.
It's now the front page of Google. It's now the first thing you find when you search for it. It's been debunked and that it's a hoax.
Look, the problem with this is that it's a really messy situation, because when this stuff started to trend and then it got deleted, the other thing that was happening on that Wednesday night is that people started posting Google Maps and, you know, Google Earth satellite images of a particular part of Marje. And this is where allegedly this craft was seen, or these objects were sighted, and where it possibly went down. We don't know exactly that. We only find out later on that it went down. But what we found out is that this photograph that comes from Google Earth just happens to have this strange white artifact precisely on the location where allegedly this UFO is. Now, the problem is why it's murky is because obviously Google Earth images are not live.
Yeah. Some of them are 10 years old.
Exactly.
Or older.
And some of them are very, very much older. So the problem is, though, is that there are a lot of people out there that get overexcited with this kind of stuff. It was like, see, it's proof that Google's trying to cover it up. And Google seemingly has actually taken this and run with it and just gone, oh, everyone that's talking about this is being ridiculous. Like, there's the statements that have come from Motherboard that have been really kind of just a little bit cynical of like, oh, look how stupid these people are. It's like, well, yeah, they may be stupid, but that doesn't mean that every single piece of evidence relating to this case should be dismissed.
Right.
And so that's where we find more details. So take a listen to what Linda said when she received this email from her Brazilian contact.
I went to my computer to check email, and there was a new one from Trajano Paiva in Brazil. He's a producer-director of WPI Films. We met at an American conference, and he keeps me updated a bit on Brazilian UFO news. His email read, "Dear Linda, this event took place in the town of Magé on the night of the 14th of May. The video was made by the people that live there and published at YouTube. Also, they did record an alleged hacking of local Magé military radio communications that night about a UFO."
So this is the intriguing piece of evidence that's come forward, is that on top of this footage that they've captured, somebody connected with these people, we don't know who, and this is what makes this difficult to, you know, discuss as being, well, this is proof, is that allegedly they've hacked into military radio communications.
How do you hack into military radio? So that just means you're listening to the signal.
Well, let's talk about that. So first of all, modern radio communications are encrypted, at least in Australia and US. They're digitally encrypted. They are almost impossible to crack. On top of that, the only way normally you can get to it is if you steal a unit from either a police car or from, you know, a military, you know, warehouse or something. That's how you can crack it. Some of the details I found today, because I wanted to look into it, is that they don't have encryption in Brazil on all of their equipment because it's some of it is slightly older. So
why are they using the term hacking? It just means that they heard a military broadcast.
Possibly.
Why is it a hack?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, maybe that's just the term they're using. But if it is encrypted, well, then maybe they have hacked it somehow. But you're right, I think hack is the wrong word. It's probably more likely they've got a stolen piece of equipment that they've utilized to get hold of
the
audio.
Well, if it's not
encrypted,
you can just be on whatever frequency they're using and listen to it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Using a radio scanner or something similar. So look, again, with that, I simply don't know, but this is the information that's been put forward. So with this, there has been a transcript that's been created of the discussion that was going on. And the transcript, I'll actually, as I said, link to this video so you can listen to the entire thing. But she was told by Paiva that, look, I've got a contact who is a translator and you can speak to her. Her name's Lisa Bick and she'll be able to translate it for you. So Linda says, great, that's really fantastic. She gets on the phone with Lisa and Lisa starts describing or just reading out the transcript, translating, you know, basically live from Portuguese to English. Now, I've cut this right down and just put the best parts of it in. But basically she goes through every time index. So there's a time index showing when discussions happen. They start around 7 p.m. They end around 10 p.m. in that kind of range.
Wow.
And there's plenty of discussion back and forward. And you can tell that there's an increasing anxiety or an increasing, excitement that's occurring with this. But this audio is a little bit sketchy, but just take a listen. This is the best parts of allegedly what that hacked radio transmission contains.
I called Portuguese translator Lisa Bick. And over the phone, she translated for me a Portuguese transcript from Trajano, allegedly from the hacked military radio communication.
7:06, start of communication by radio between the military teams, base 1, 2, 3, and 4. Confirms the damage of the object with an American shot. Everything is smashed, damaged. And there is no way we can put it there. There are more bodies inside. These things are not people. It doesn't have human appearance. Did you copy? Freeze all cell phones from the guards. Did you copy? Do not allow anyone to record anything. The American corps from Alcantara is going to the base position and will retrieve the objects. It is to operate within the AGIA protocol.
The English translation is eagle.
I think I got the gist of that. I mean, obviously it was mentioned the bodies weren't human.
Yeah.
The start of her words was getting cut off a bit. That's just the quality of
the audio. That's just the quality of it. I don't think it's the processing that we've done. It was just because of the audio call that was happening. Maybe it was some processing done through Linda. I'm not sure. But what is important that we should take away from that is a couple of things. First of all, is that allegedly the Americans shot it down. Secondly, is that when they came to the site, they found that there were bodies inside and outside that weren't human. Something I didn't include in there, but was part of the audio transcript, was that there were bodies outside the craft, but they'd been smashed to pieces, or there was some type of, dispersal of them. So it was obviously a high impact or a high speed impact of whatever this craft or wherever it went down. The other thing in there is the mention of Project Aguila. Sorry, not Project Aguila, the Aguila protocols. Now, Linda said there at the end that she translated that and found out that it means eagle. It was kind of an afterthought, I think, for her. But I looked into it, and this is odd. So apparently in the 1990s, when McDonnell Douglas and Boeing were looking at developing stealth craft, the program, so when you have a program, you have multiple projects underneath the program. The program was essentially based on bird names. And so everything underneath that had some type of bird name attached to it. Whatever the craft that they were developing would be a Raptor, or I don't know the full details of it. But it's strange that allegedly that program was shut down in the 1990s, and yet you've got reference to Eagle protocols. Now, I don't know. I wonder if this isn't possibly an exotic craft, apart from the fact that they're saying there are not human bodies inside. But maybe the fact that the Americans are allegedly involved, are they recovering some type of experimental aircraft that's being flown by midgets? I don't know.
Chimps, but maybe. Chimps. Like when you build a $100 billion experimental aircraft, you're not going to put a human in there. Naturally, you're going to get a chimp to fly it. Makes total sense.
And then shoot it down. Look, I just think that's a weird connection, and I don't think that's necessarily what's going on here. But maybe this Eagle protocol is some type of program that they have. Maybe they have some type of global deployment for recovering crashed craft. And the reason why I say that is because we know that allegedly these programs have existed with Project Moondust. If you have a look in the show notes, I'll link to an ExoPolitics Journal article that was published by Michael Sulla back in 2005. And he allegedly interviewed a specialist sergeant by the name of Clifford Stone. And Clifford Stone claims that he spent 22 years in the military as a special access UFO retrieval operator.
Yeah, I don't think the allegedly is Sulla interviewing the guy. I think is where Clifford Stone is actually who he says he is.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, he definitely interviewed him.
Yeah,
it's allegedly whether or not what he's saying is true. Apparently, the reason why he's describing what happened to him and why he came forward is, first of all, he was just a clerk. Apparently, his MOS was that he was a clerk of some kind. But he did this for 20
years. That's his cover.
That was his cover, exactly. Yeah, because they don't have an MOS for
biological entity. It's like Steven Seagal was the chef.
Yeah, pretty much the same kind of thing. And maybe that's where he got it from. But Sulla, you know, interviewed him and continued to talk to him about his experiences. And Stone claims that he came forward because, first of all, he tried to retire. And when he tried to retire, apparently the second group, like this hidden group within the military, was like,
you know too much.
Yeah, kind of that thing, you're not retiring. We still need you. And he was deployed to Germany. So he claims that he was involved in a European group that was part of a network of people deployed around the world that were sent for secondments and exchanges and that kind of thing, when in reality their job was to act as a retrieval program, this global retrieval program. And so if something happened in Europe, there would be this code word that would be said, something like, the general sends his regards. And that's when they would know to go and grab
the general sends his regards.
I know. I mean, that's corny. That's corny in itself.
But how would that come up in conversation? Whoever you're talking to would be like,
no, it'd be like, what? A phone call. It'd be like, the general sends his regards. And then, like, well, gotta go. And
what if there is a general who sends his regards? It'd be very confusing.
I think details would be given as to where they were supposed to go. I don't think it just could be simply, you know, like, the general sends his regards.
Well, tell him I said hi. Yeah.
So with this, though, it demonstrates that at least in the community, in this kind of UFO community, there is allegations that this type of program has been outgoing for a long time. So it would make sense that there would be a group that would be ready to be deployed in Brazil to go and recover a crashed craft.
So is there any connection with this idea of crashed retrievals and the Eagle protocol?
No. So unfortunately, I couldn't find that. Would I merely be speculating if I tried to find that? So I couldn't. There is no reference at all to the Eagle protocol. All I can find that relates to anything that is Eagle is Boeing and McDonnell Douglas programs that were conducted in the 1990s in relation to stealth.
Things called Eagle.
That's the thing as well. I mean, Eagle is a very, you know, especially when it comes to anything aviation, it's almost cliche. It's like, of course, if it's aviation, you're going to call, I mean, they call planes birds. So it would kind of make sense that maybe it's something completely unconnected. However, the fact that this thing seems to have been expunged completely from the internet is what makes this really surreal. And I had my own personal experience with this that made it even more bizarre, which is why I wanted to mention it. So a couple of things have been happening in Australia. Now, just on Saturday, there was this sighting over Victoria. In fact, probably close to where you're going to be talking about, Ben, in your section of the show. But I'll put this video in as well. There's something very odd because this strange object lit up the skies over southeastern Victoria, which left experts stunned as to what this could be. So when you look at it, at first it looks like a shooting star. It kind of looks like a shooting star, but it travels for such a long time that it goes on for about 40 seconds. You can see this thing moving through the sky.
When I got a haircut 2 days ago, the hairdresser was talking about this.
Oh, really?
Because she said her husband is heavily researching this stuff.
Right.
And he's convinced it was a foreign spy satellite.
Oh, so, okay, so that's the thing that's happening here.
And I asked her, why does he think that? She said, I don't know. She just had no idea. But yeah, there must be some kind of conspiracy going around.
Well, apparently there have been senators that have been talking about, a senator saw this, a Tasmanian senator, Peter Wish, saw this as well. So this is being witnessed by people and they're talking about it. So because I think maybe a senator is talking about it, it's why the government has made official announcements on it. And they've actually come out from an observatory, one of the government observatory, saying, well, no, it's not a meteorite because it went on for too long. It's not a comet because normally comets should be traveling a lot further up. You shouldn't be able to see it for that long either. They're speculating that it's debris from a Russian rocket. But the odd thing is I couldn't find, and maybe I'm wrong, but I couldn't find any reference anywhere online to any recent Russian rocket launches.
Why would a Russian rocket be on this side of the world?
Exactly.
It's probably a Chinese spy satellite.
So maybe it's a Chinese spy satellite.
Huawei fell apart.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe it's a spy satellite. Maybe that's why they're being very quiet about it. But it's just very odd that the details about Marje seem to be suppressed. It seems like, and it's just not on one level, it seems like multiple different platforms, including Google, have deliberately gone out of their way to eradicate this. And why? Why would they want to do that? If it's just simply a hoax, well, then leave it up. Let people make their own choice. I mean, this is being seen in Australia, and even though it possibly is a spy satellite, they're still leaving it up. People aren't tearing it down. So for me, it suggests that there's actually more going on here than people realize. And I will keep an eye on it. I'll keep an eye on Linda's site as well, and we'll report back to you.
You were saying there was a strange bang heard in the nation's capital as well.
Oh, yeah, that's weird. So Canberra is known occasionally for getting these strange explosive sounds that happen. And by explosive sound, I mean the entire city hears it. It's like
houses shake.
It's more than a clap of thunder. It's incredibly strange. And it actually happened the other day. It happened last week. And with that, the odd thing about it is it was preceded by someone taking a photograph of a lenticular cloud that was just sitting on the outskirts of the city. And it looked like this beautiful UFO. And people on local social media were joking and saying, oh, it's a UFO, it's aliens. And that very night, there was this massive explosion. But the reason why this one was different is because of two things. One, there was an orange flash that was seen in the sky just before the explosion was heard. So obviously sound travels slower than light, but it seemed to be associated. And the other thing was, is that people heard it not only in Canberra, but hundreds of kilometres away as well. That's how loud it was. It was heard for hundreds of kilometres. And it was so well known, it was heard, that the Defence Department and Geoscience Australia actually got involved and had to come out and say, we weren't conducting any operations. So it's
weren't
nothing.
Weren't you? Really?
So it's nothing we know anything about. So it's odd, but I'll link to all of it in the show notes so you can have a look at it for yourself. Make sure you check out Linda's video. I think she's done actually a really good job with this. And I'll keep you up to date as to what's going on with Marje. It's very, very strange.
And so you're 100% sure we can't see that video though? It's gone.
You can see the video through Linda's website.
She's got an exclusive
and
on it.
What people have done is that they've taken, so if you search for that video from Linda, they've done poor video edits to take it from her video.
Oh, I see.
And you know it's poor because it's really low res. So it's like a 13-year-old that's like, oh, it's a cool UFO video.
Okay.
And put it up. So yeah, there are those. But the actual original the original video files that were being described on social media are gone. I don't know. I don't know what to make of it. I'm a little bit concerned because I know that there's always been, we know obviously that there's been a cover-up. We've done enough stories on the show about allegedly true UFO incidents, not just crashes, but incidents and contacts, that there's always been some type of cover-up going, but it seems like it's really hardcore now. It's the new age of covering things up. So in the past, it was a weather balloon. Now it just disappears from social media with the flick of a button.
Well, let's move from UFOs to missing people. We've got a lot of local content on this episode. There's that article I mentioned from John Sylvester, the crime reporter here in Australia. The button man could be the key to mounting mountain mystery.
Oh, that was terrible.
It's his headline, not mine.
Yeah, I know that. I'm not blaming you.
Victoria's higher country is a place of beauty and mystery that remains reluctant to give up its secrets, Sylvester writes. So he mentions a few days ago, police launched a search in this remote area of the state in Victoria here in Australia, the Bunyip State Park, like I mentioned earlier. They were looking for signs of Dale Pantic. He was this drug dealer from the area who went missing 13 months ago. And they've found nothing. Haven't found a thing, no trace of the guy. He just vanished.
Why are they looking in that area, though? Was his car left there or something?
This was where he was last seen. They traced his phone and traced his car. He went to visit a friend who lived in the area, mm-hmm. and then the car kind of, they lost track of it, basically. So they knew that this was a good place to look.
Yep.
Because that's where he was last seen. The police knew that if they found this car, they might be able to crack the case on this missing guy. And they haven't. Been completely fruitless. So Sylvester writes that in recent years, there have been experienced hunters, well-equipped bushwalkers, campers and day trippers who have just disappeared without a trace from this area. No evidence of what had happened. And this is why he says you have all these rumors start to swirl around the mystery. Now, going into Dale Pantic, this drug dealer who went missing, he's a father of five. Police believe he meant foul play, so they're suspecting he was murdered. But when you look into some of the stories about him, he's apparently a very low-level drug dealer, you know.
Yeah, but things can go wrong when you're dealing drugs, I suppose.
Things can go wrong, but is there that much murders?
Not in Australia.
Outside of bikie gangs in Australia?
Not as far as I'm aware.
So there's a tearful plea from his 11-year-old daughter that was all over the media. He told his wife and his kids that he was making a quick, you know, errand and then he would be back in Melbourne, but he just disappeared. He never showed up. So this was kind of all part of a call for more information from people in this area where his car was last seen. Now, it just so happened today, I looked for an update on the story and they found his car.
Oh, today?
Yeah, they found his car. It was a few hours after I started researching this story. There was an update from Victoria Police. They found his missing Ford at Bunyip State Forest. So initially,
in the right area.
Initially it was thought that they should be looking in this area for the guy because that's where he was last seen. But now it's confirmed that's where his car was. The thing was, there's no evidence of what occurred from the car. Like, it doesn't give them any further clues. Maybe it gives them an area for more searching, but we still don't know what happened to the guy. And you know, this is why people speculate about this area, because people go missing and there's just no evidence. And that leads Sylvester to mention someone who might know what's going on, and that's the button man. So as soon as I started reading about this guy, I was hooked on this story. He's apparently an expert bushman. He got his nickname because he used deer antlers to make buttons.
Oh.
And he makes kind of large plugs for his ear piercings. He's apparently 70 years old, this guy, but he moves like he's in his 20s through the forest.
And is this accomplished outdoorsman?
Well, if you can find him, you could ask him that question, but no one can track the guy down. He's made a camp apparently on the side of a remote mountain in the area, and basically it's set up so that he can see anyone come into the park. He can see approaching vehicles. So it's almost like he's set himself up to keep a lookout on what's going on.
Mm.
They say he uses snares to catch deer. He hunts with an Aboriginal-style spear. And campers and hunters all have these stories about the button man. Like, apparently he'll just emerge out of the forest silently and just appear at your campsite. He's described...
He'll do what?
Well, he'll often ask the campers questions. Like, what are you doing here? How long are you going to stay? You know, he wants to find out about you and what you're going to do. But when people ask him questions, he just ignores it. He doesn't reply. He doesn't give any information.
And what, disappears like Homer into a bush?
Yeah, he basically vanishes into the wilderness. So again, he's 70 years old, short gray hair. He wears dark jackets. He's got some strange scar on his face. Others say he's intimidating, he's spooky, but no one's reported him ever being violent or even threatening violence. He basically grills people on what they're doing and then he disappears. He goes back into the wilderness. Now, at least 8 experienced bushmen have had encounters with him. One of them saying he had a 1,000-meter stare, this guy, that made the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. And they say no one knows he's near until he decides to make himself known. And there's this crazy story from a wildlife photographer who was in the area taking shots near Button Man's camp. And when he returned home, he took out, you know, his little SD cards from his camera and started loading all the photos onto his computer. And one of the photos wasn't taken by him. It was a photo of himself sleeping in his sleeping bag.
Oh, that's creepy.
Inside his tent. And he suspects it was the Button Man that took the shot. So someone, the Button Man snuck up on his campsite, took his camera, turned it on, took a photo, put it back in the case, zipped up the tent without him hearing a thing.
Is it to demonstrate how vulnerable you are out there?
Well, it's almost like a game for the guy. Like,
yeah,
he enjoys sneaking up on the experienced hunters just to show how superior he is with his bushcraft. And he also leaves these strange rock pyramids at random spots. Sometimes he'll leave them along the road on the way into the park. Now, people don't know why he does it. One speculation is that he's seeing if they've been disturbed so he can see if a vehicle's come through. That might be one reason. They might be markers for someone else or something else maybe. Apparently, bushmen who spend a lot of time in the wilderness in this area, they have firewood supplies. So, you know, the next time they go out camping, they know where they've got all this prepared firewood. And they've gone out there and said that the stash is gone. Like, this very carefully hidden stash of firewood is now emptied. And they're basically telling the journalists here that the only way anyone could find this stash is if I was being watched while I hid it.
Well, he probably was.
And that's their point, is that this guy is silent and he's watching you if you're in this park. So Sylvester points out that obviously people can get into trouble easily in the wilderness. You know, you can get lost, you can break an ankle and not get out of rough terrain, you can get bitten by a snake, have a medical episode. There's plenty of reasons why people can go missing in the forest.
And it's rough terrain out there and temperatures fluctuate and vary quite, you know, rapidly. So all those things can catch you off guard.
Yeah, a lot of people can just die from exposure if they don't get back to the camp. But he says when you have a number of cases starting to show up in such a small radius, this is a 60-kilometer radius.
Yeah, this is a missing 411 kind of scenario.
Well, it's not quite missing 411 because we don't have people's bodies turning up yet. Mm. So far, there's nothing like that. In missing 411, you have an area where search teams have been over 10 times and then 3 weeks later, the body will show up. That's super weird. We don't have this here. People's bodies don't show up at all. So he looks at this map here of the cases from Victorian High Country. So first, this is one you might be familiar with because it's been in the news recently. There's Russell Hill and Carol Clay. They're both in their early 70s. They disappeared on March the 20th this year from their campsite on Dry River Track at Wanangatta. Hill was a former bush logger. He knew the area really well. Their campsite had been completely burnt out, though, and their camper utility, you know, the trailer vehicle that they had, was completely abandoned.
It's rather raunchy, this story, though, because they're both, as you said, Ben, they're older. They're in their 70s. And basically, the guy went camping with the head of the Country Women's Association. Yeah. So it turns out that the wife, Mrs. Hill, is like, oh, I don't know why they're both camping out there. I hope they come home.
Apparently, it's
so
super,
having an affair.
They're obviously having an affair. They're both married
scandalous.
To different people. But it's really awkward. As you read between the lines with the quotes from the families in the press. They really don't want to talk about why they were camping. They just want them found. But the families were friends. They were like close families.
Yeah, very tight-knit.
And now the wife of the missing man is finding out that this isn't the first time they went camping together. It's really, I feel sorry for her. you know, imagine
it's a horrible
double whammy of a husband going missing and finding out he was cheating on her. But there's no evidence that they eloped. That might, you know, come to mind that they decided to just go somewhere else together because their phones haven't been used, their credit cards, bank accounts haven't been touched. They haven't engineered their own disappearance, of course. And there's no idea what happened to their campsite, why it just completely burnt down.
Yeah.
Forensics have gone through there. There's some suggestion that maybe a phone charger blew up, but...
Yeah, because they found no accelerant. This is the odd thing. So when I was reading about it, there was no accelerant found that would be consistent with the fire burning that rapidly. They said it would have been a rapid fire, but it could be the petrochemicals in the tent. But you're right, Ben. They were like, oh, it must be a phone charger. But for a phone charger to do that, it's pretty unlikely.
Yeah, so these are the latest guys that have gone missing in Bunyip State Park. And there's nothing for the police to go on. They're going to, I was reading today, there's another search party being organised for the coming weeks to try and find something out there.
I did read something today, actually, that there was a fresh twist in the story.
Well, they found a body.
Oh, that's what it was. Yeah, right. But this is the thing. So they found a body right near the campsite where their camp had been burnt down. And they thought, well, that must be, I think they thought it was male. So they said, oh, that must be Mr. Hill. But the new details are, is that the body is completely unrelated.
Yeah, they have no idea who this person is. So at least someone's been found, though.
And that's the missing 411 element there.
It could be Niels Becker. Now, Niels Becker was 39. He went missing last year. He was an experienced bushwalker. He went on a 5-day hike, never came back. He left the Upper Jameson Hut on October the 24th. 2 days later, sent a message to his family from another hut he was hiking to. He said he was heading to his car at Mount Sterling. The last confirmed sighting of the guy was by the Button Man. The Button Man.
So that's why they're talking to the Button Man.
The Button Man actually told police that he saw the hiker. And, you know, told them which direction he was heading. It's funny because the Button Man's camp is actually at this point called the Crossroads. Hmm. And most of the hikers go through this area because it's the only place where you'll get good radio reception.
Right.
So everyone kind of goes there to radio in which way they're heading.
And isn't that what happened with that elderly couple, that they did radio in? They did touch base and then that was the last thing anyone heard. And I think that was 11 days when I last read about it.
Like, I can't remember.
But that's why they were there, because they were trying to make a radio contact. But they said everything was fine.
Yeah. Well, he's still missing, this guy. It was a gift to himself to do this massive hike on his 39th birthday. And he was training for it as well. His interviews with his parents saying how he would, you know, walk around with a big, heavy pack. He was super fit. He was a really intelligent young guy. No evidence of where he's gone or what happened to him. Then there's Conrad Whitlock. He's 72 years old when he went missing. No one knows what's happened to this guy. He drove into the high country in July of last year again. No one knows why he left his white BMW in the darkness on the side of Mount Buller Road. He left his jacket in the car. He left his mobile phone and his keys in the car. So if that's the case, if you leave all this stuff in the car, you would think he just took a few steps to take a piss or something.
Yeah.
He just needed a bathroom break. But there's no evidence of any foul play. There's no evidence of anything. He's just vanished. There's no suicide note. He didn't have any issues at home.
This is what we really need to actually emphasize, is the fact that these people that have disappeared don't seem to indicate in any way that they were suicidal or that they wanted to disappear. A lot of them were just, you know, some of them had new jobs, you know, had families. There's no reason for them just to disappear. But also on top of that, you have this area that, yeah, we're like, okay, it's a wilderness area. And as you said, Ben, people can disappear. But it's this cluster factor, because we have a lot of national parks in Australia. We have beautiful, incredible national parks. This area is an absolute hotspot of disappearances, unlike anywhere else in the country.
Well, one of the biggest mysteries was David Prideaux. And the journalist, Sylvester, said he actually met him a couple of times, said he was a smart, energetic guy. He was the Barwon prison governor. So there was all these conspiracy theories that, you know, criminals that he'd locked up had a vengeance against him and followed him into the forest. But the thing was, the guy was a really experienced hunter. And when he went missing, this was back in 2011, he went missing with his brother-in-law while they were hunting. They ended up splitting up and saying, you know, I'll meet you back here in 5 hours or something. And he just never came back.
Yeah.
There's no evidence of what happened to him at all. He's just gone. He was actually declared dead on July of 2014. In the report, The police said, look, there's no evidence that he engineered his disappearance. He didn't fake his death, in other words. You know, his credit cards haven't been used, bank account hasn't been touched. Neither is there any evidence of foul play. Like, we can't say he was murdered. There's just nothing to go on, basically.
How long do you have to be missing in Australia before you're declared dead? I think in the US it's like something like 7 or 9 years.
Well, that's only 3 years that he went missing. But when he went missing, he had a UHF radio on him. He had a GPS device. So it's not like he would have gotten lost. He'd been hunting in this wilderness, you know, countless times before. He knew it like the back of his hand. He's gone. Warren Meyer, he's 57. He disappeared from Dom Dom Saddle in March of 2008. This is kind of in the same area as well. Again, another experienced bushwalker. He had a GPS with him. He had his phone, plenty of food and water. Never heard from again, completely gone. No clues, nothing. So with this couple, this kind of juicy story of this couple going missing, it's back in the news. And Sylvester's really just pointing out that now people in the area are starting to talk because the button man keeps coming up in these stories. So an obvious question is the button man murdering these people? Is he actually a killer? So some of the stories that are getting around, one of them comes from an experienced shooter he spoke to who claims, you know, he'd been in this area a ton of times. He always camps out. But one night he set an alarm because he wanted to go hunting at night. So his alarm goes off at 11 p.m. and the button man is sleeping next to him.
Hello.
The button man's just at his camp snoozing. And this is where he's saying, like, he does this just to show the hunters just how skilled he is at getting through the wilderness. Kind of like a game to him. So the police ended up tracking him down. They had a general idea of where his camp was. They actually wanted his help. He wasn't necessarily a suspect, although not officially.
Yeah.
But they wanted to see if he could help them with the terrain, if they knew where these people might have been heading. Essentially, he did speak to the police, but there's no details on what he shared. And there's still all these sightings of the guy in the wilderness. People see him. Apparently, he sometimes goes into town to buy supplies, so he's not just completely staying in the wilderness.
You've got to wonder if there's something supernatural occurring here. I said to you earlier in the day, Ben, I'm wondering if this is a window area, you know, that we hear about around the world. But I wonder if he knows that. I wonder if he knows something about it, but he's just being quiet about it.
Well, he doesn't like to talk at all, which is natural for a hermit.
Oh, of course.
I mean, they want to keep to themselves. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he's observing everyone that comes into the park, he wants to know who's coming in. He's setting up these rock pyramids for some kind of communication purpose or to see if they've been disturbed. It could be that he just thinks the park is his.
Yeah, he could just be extremely eccentric.
He's a bit mentally ill and he's very possessive of the park, but maybe he's trying to keep an eye on people for a reason. Maybe he does know more about why people are going missing, what's happened to these people. So again, I don't think it crosses over into the real mysterious missing 411, but it is strange. And I find the button man fascinating. At the end of this article, Sylvester says, what makes him tick? He asked the question, what's going through this guy's head? So following that thread, I wanted to find more on hermits in Australia. Actually, before I did that, I did a quick search on Bunyip State Park. I wanted to see if there was UFO sightings in the area. I wanted to see if there was other strange, you know, Bigfoot type sightings.
You know, there's smoke monster reports in that region in Victoria.
In the Bunyip?
I'm not exactly sure if it's in Bunyip, but I know that in some of the forests there are anecdotal reports of smoke monster style entities hanging around there.
Okay.
So I wouldn't be surprised. I can't find it. It's not in front of me right now, but yeah, I've heard stories like that from Victoria and I've always dismissed them as being, you know, probably urban legends.
Well, I didn't find anything like that, but I went searching the Yowie forums.
Oh, yeah.
You know, our Bigfoot. And there was a recent report from someone who had just been to Bunyip State Park and he claimed he had an encounter there. And he tells this story about how him and his girlfriend, they just wanted to get out, do some exercise. So they decided to explore Bunyip State Park. He went from a different side he's never been to before. He usually comes up from the south, but he went in through the kind of northwest. And he says, as we were driving in, we saw deer crossing the road in front of us. He said, I've never seen a deer in the Australian bush before, so that was kind of cool. But basically, they parked the car and he and his girlfriend walked about a kilometer or so into the bush. And he said, that's when he started to notice some weird things. The first thing was some kind of structure that just didn't look natural. just the way the trees were lent together, it looked like some kind of enclosure had been, you know, put together. But the branches were huge. They were like giant tree logs put together. He says whatever it was, it had taken a lot of force to, you know, get them to stick so strongly. He said, I took a photo of the structure, and as I paused to take a photo, I heard what was like a deep thud. And just hears this big boom kind of resonate, this real low frequency thud. And he said it, he could almost feel it through the ground, like something had just big, it just dropped. And his girlfriend heard it as well. She's a little bit freaked out. They were on high alert. But they decided to keep on walking and just get their exercise. And about another kilometer down the track, he said they found another one of these structures. Two really large branches kind of turned upside down like a teepee, bracing each other, and then branches kind of stuck into the ground, like almost like pegs for a tent. Like it didn't look natural. Like something huge has picked up this tree and turned it upside down to make it something.
Did he take any photos of this?
Yeah, he took a bunch of photos, but they're not loading in the forum.
Oh, okay.
They're kind of dead images now. They've been covered up. Google removed them.
Yep.
And he claims he looked further into the distance, and behind this structure of the kind of upturned tree, he looks and there's an archway. It's like something has come and bent all the trees and branches over and kind of woven them together. And there's this archway. It looked like he were going into Chinatown or something. It's really strange. And as he's walking to this spot, he suddenly starts to realize that along the kind of track they're on, there's like branches, almost like a fence leading up to this archway. It's almost like something's...
like a weird Bigfoot wedding chapel or something?
Well, no, someone explained it later. That's what you would use to funnel prey into a particular area.
Oh, that's actually really clever.
And he didn't know this, but he's basically being funneled into the prey area. And just as he's about to walk through this archway, his girlfriend goes, hey, listen. And he's like, what? She says, there's no sound.
The Oz effect.
There's no birds. Yep. There's nothing. Listen to how quiet it is. This is weird. So she's starting to really freak out, and he... it's funny because he's on the Yowie forums and, you know, he's interested in Bigfoot reports and stuff like that. So he kind of knows not to just freak out and run away. He says to his girlfriend, look, wait, I want to try something before we go. He picks up a big branch and boom, whacks it against the nearest tree. And they just wait. And then off in the distance, there's this crack in reply. Something is cracking a tree back at them.
Something was waiting and listening.
So he says to his girlfriend, okay, here's my phone and I want you to record the next crack and we're going to get this on audio. So he does another crack against the tree. She presses record. Nothing. No reply.
It knows.
And he says it's almost like it knew we were trying to record this and stopped
it does know.
Communicating.
Yeah, the intelligence knows.
So eventually they made it back to the car. Nothing weird after that. But, you know, it was just odd. This is in the exact area where people have been going missing. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, it's more it might than a
not
coincidence.
It might not be something weird. It might just be a hermit out there who's hitting a tree. It might be the killer of all these people hitting the tree who's not a Bigfoot. It's just a guy out there. But it's funny because I started going through this forum and looking for replies. Someone actually said, you know, years ago I was on one of the Aussie 4x4 forums, you know, for people that go cross country in their four-wheel drives. And there was a post about Yowies or a thread about Yowies. And one of the posters said, while he was traveling on a dirt road in this same park, Bunyip State Park, he saw a carcass hanging from a tree 15 feet up. Like something had put a deer carcass 15 feet up in a tree. And all of its limbs were torn off. It was just a torso hanging up there. Like some kind of Wookiee trap.
Yeah. I don't know what to think of that. You know, that when you were describing it, it's like he was being led into a trap. It reminds me of a story that I think came from Ron Moorhead. If you recall that it was either him or someone he knew was out in the American wilderness. And they said that they felt like a kind of like a electrical kind of sensation. And they said it was almost like they reached in or they were moving towards something and something reached out of nothingness and tried to grab hold of him. And he heard something like gotcha or something.
Oh, wow.
And he felt like he was being if he had stepped forward, yeah. this arm would have grabbed him and pulled him in.
Well, they're the kind of stories I was looking for related to this park.
Yeah, like more interdimensional kind of stuff.
And because he mentioned the 4x4 forums, the four-wheel drive forums, I thought it's been a while since I've looked at those, because people that spend enough time in their cars driving out in the wilderness, they often see weird things yeah. crossing the road.
Oh, that's sometimes a really great, you know, resource.
So I went looking for that story of the carcass hanging in the tree. I wanted to find the original post, but unfortunately a lot of those forums are gone now.
Yeah.
There's just one or two that have kind of consolidated and the old ones are gone. But I did find a couple of threads from these 4x4 enthusiasts talking about panthers they'd seen in the wilderness.
Oh.
Just massive black cats. One guy said he saw one leap across the road chasing a fox, but it was huge. It wasn't a feral cat. It was a big black yep. panther. Another guy swears he saw two kangaroos. Now, hang on. They had kangaroo heads, but they were like mutant kangaroos. He said,
what
you know
do you
how
mean, like malnourished?
Well, no, he said they were kind of like sausage dogs. Like their legs were really short, but they had kangaroo faces and they were kind of like dog shaped. And there was two of them going across the road.
Was it just like really ugly dash hounds or something?
No, he said they had heads like kangaroos. Like they look like mutants. That was his word. They look like two mutants. I don't know what they were. I've never seen anything like it, but I swear there was two weird mutant kangaroos that crossed the road. And they weren't hopping. They were walking like dogs.
There's got to be a genetic abnormality or something going on there.
Yeah, it's a sausage dog breeding with a dingo or something.
So, yeah. And a kangaroo. There used to be a kangaroo in the mix somewhere there.
A threesome with a kangaroo. The other weird one was another poster swears on his life in the middle of the outback somewhere. I can't remember what state. I think he was in Queensland. He claims he saw two hyenas.
Hyenas. You know what? Actually, I'm kind of not surprised with that because, I mean, I know it's like an old skeptical kind of argument, but, you know, we used to have a lot of circuses here in the 70s. 70s and 80s circuses were kind of a big thing. So I wouldn't be surprised if a circus had a heap of animals and they just dumped them.
Yeah, he swears. He's seen a million nature documentaries. He knows what a hyena looks like. Yeah. He said there were definitely two hyenas.
Well, actually, the other thing, it could be something a little bit more exotic. I mean, he's saying, hyena, but it could have been a marsupial lion, which are, you know, supposed to be extinct, but it could just be an allegedly extinct species.
Really?
Yeah. Ask Rex Gilroy. He'll be able to show you a fresh paw print for them.
But again, I that was kind of a dead end. So I wanted to find more on the hermits. So after searching around for these weird characters, the first one I found was Gregory Smith. And he was featured on Australian Story, which is like a show run by the Australian Broadcasting ABC. Commission, yep. the ABC. It ran a few years ago. And I just thought the story was really intriguing. So let me read you some of the story here just to give you a sense of the family background and what led this guy to the life he would ultimately lead. Mm-hmm. So through the 1960s, Gregory Smith's father cast a shadow of fear over the entire family. And when he came after the kids, Gregory's mother, Beryl, didn't really protect them. There's a story from his older sister, Glenda West, who recalled her first life lesson in the family. When she was six, her mother punched her in the stomach for accidentally overfilling the washing machine. So this is the kind of violent abuse and parenting they were receiving. Mm. In 1965, Gregory's mother took her children to St. Patrick's Orphanage in Armidale here in New South Wales. We're not in New South Wales. But she returned 6 weeks later and picked them up. Then 5 months after, she put them back in the orphanage. You know, Greg was only 10 when this went on. So they were basically in and out of orphanages their whole life.
Traumatizing to
when they weren't in an orphanage, they were being beat up by their parents. So he was basically traumatized by the experience. At the orphanage, he said he was sometimes locked in a closet for non-compliance for up to 8 hours a day. Like he's locked in solitary. By the time he was 15, he was in and out of juvenile justice centers. He had been told by social workers that he had low IQ, and a state psychiatrist diagnosed him as a sociopath. At the age of imagine being told you're a sociopath at the age of 15.
Sad.
By his mid-20s, Gregory was homeless. He lived on the streets around Sydney. He very quickly became an alcoholic. And this is what he would be doing for the next 20 years of his life, is really battling this addiction, battling anger. And he must have got his life together at some stage, because he was working and he was married. He was in a home, stable home. Life was pretty stable. He was keeping the alcohol at bay. And then in this period between 1979 and 1980, it's like everything just collapsed. Maybe he lost control. Maybe he went back to the booze. But basically in this short period of time, he lost his wife. His marriage collapsed. He burnt down his own home. He spent time at a psychiatric hospital and had a near-fatal car crash. All in this period.
What a tortured soul.
So after this, they kind of set the scene where his life was just in such disarray. His only option was to leave society.
Yep.
And that's what he did. He tells the story of being in Mullumbimby in, you know, middle of nowhere, New South Wales. And he just started following this dirt road. He just thought, yeah, I'm just going to go up this dirt road, just walk up this dirt road and see what happens. And at the end of the road, there was Goonangarry National Park. It's this 442-hectare massive forest. And he said, I ended up there because I had nowhere else to go. So he ended up building a fire pit. He made a small table out of bush rocks. And when he's interviewed by the TV crew, he basically said, I finally had control in the forest. It's like I had time to think. I had time to settle down and figure out what's going on. He ended up building a log bed with a mattress of ferns on a slab of lava rock. And as I was watching this, I thought, maybe this is a story about a guy who needed to leave society to get control of himself and actually emerged victorious.
Yeah, he needed like a reset.
Like he became this really skilled bushman and, you know, he was hunting for kangaroo and surviving on nature and just, you know, becoming a real wild man, but mastering himself. But then I heard him describe what his first couple of weeks were like in that forest.
Yeah, about 3 weeks in, I find myself eating anything that crawled. I've eaten beetles, worm, grubs. I started hunting land mullet, lizards, any lizard. The forest took me back to when I was in that cupboard under the stairs in the orphanage, and I'd formed that place in my mind, you know, of no humans, you know, just a nice soft place. I was never going to glean enough produce from the forest to satisfy my addictions, so I established a nice little area north of my camp whereby I could grow some marijuana plants.
Oh, good. That's what you need. When you're eating just bugs and worms, the only way to enhance your wildlife experience is just to be baked the entire time.
Well, it sounds like he's in the ultimate form of escapism, because he's saying that he felt like he was back inside his, you know, under that cupboard,
yeah,
in that safe space. And then, yeah, I mean, I don't blame him for smoking something to allow him to escape.
Well, it turns out the weed was really a way just to get back to the alcohol.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Let's take a listen.
Just that simple action opened up a whole trading network for me. It took me to the Byron Bay Market. It took me to Sydney. You know, it took me to lots of places. Some of that horticultural product I traded for cash, and I was able to buy homebrew kits. It was quite a lethal brew that brought me to my knees.
Hang on, I thought he was a hermit, and then all of a sudden he's a drug dealer.
I know, it's a really weird story. So, yeah, he grew marijuana, and then he got into the drug trade. So he just used it as a resource to get a homebrew kit.
Out of the bush.
He took the homebrew kit out into the forest and just made this wicked homebrew. And this is where I started to realize why his memory was all over the place, because when he was first interviewed by the ABC, he told them that he had lived in the forest for 10 years. And when they went and interviewed local landowners to verify this story, they said, oh no, he's been here for 12 months. So his idea of time got so distorted because he was whacked out on this crazy homebrew that he just lost all track of time. And one of the reasons he couldn't remember what was going on is because he was talking to aliens. Let's take a listen.
My lineal recollection of time is not all that good. I don't have a lot of clarity around those couple of years in the forest because it was mixed in with psychosis. I'm off having conversations with some aliens or gremlins or my ancestors. My ancestors were saying, you can't live like this. And they're saying that they're concerned about me and that my health is deteriorating.
So the way that the ABC has portrayed this is all his psychosis. He's just out there in the bush going crazy. And yeah, on one side, that's 100% true.
Well, let's also mix in massive amounts of alcohol.
But on the other side, he's having these really intriguing experiences where his ancestors...
They're kind of shamanic in a way.
Yeah, they're actually telling him that his path in life is wrong. He needs to change his ways. He's going to kill himself. They're telling him that this is not the way to go forward. This is not the way to live his life. And at the same time, he's describing gremlins. And it's funny, reading this and getting to hear how addicted he was to substances... The first thing it brought to mind for me was how possessing entities use the substance addiction and the substance abuse as a way to get in and start controlling people. And he was suffering from all this incredible psychosis. You know, he couldn't keep track of time. He had no idea what was going on. And, you know, when you put it into that perspective with his next statement, it really starts to line up because there were points in his life where he just had no idea what had happened. Like large amounts of time had passed.
As in he was zoned out, you mean? That something else could have been?
Yeah, it was like someone else was taking control of his body for long periods of time. Let's take a listen.
I have no recollection of months after I exited the forest. The very next consciousness that I have was actually sitting on a park bench at the back of the Tweed Heads Hospital. I was still very sick. I still had psychosis. There was still a lot of confusion in my mind. And all of a sudden it struck me. I had created all this damage. I had caused all this mess. I thought I was fighting other people. I was fighting myself. My whole life I'd been fighting myself. And I remember dropping to my knees and I'm thinking, I don't want to fight anymore. So I made a decision there on that park bench that I would do whatever it took not to be the person that I was there that day.
So I thought that was amazing.
Yeah.
He's so controlled by his addictions. He's seen the best decades of his life just pass by in a blur of substance abuse. He finds himself not understanding how he got to this park bench after leaving the forest. And yet he's still in this brief moment of clarity, looks inside and realizes that he's the problem, that he is the only person that can take control of his destiny get himself out of this horrible situation.
But maybe it took that long for him to realize. I mean, either fix yourself or you die.
It's just such a great moment where he understands the truth of his situation and he doesn't blame anyone else. He doesn't blame society. He doesn't, you know, say it's because of this or it's because of my parents or my upbringing. He says, I'm here because of what I've done.
Yep.
And so you think, okay, this is a real pivotal point in his life. And he must have been tempted to go back to the substances to start drinking again and everything else, maybe to even go back to the wilderness. And I thought, where's this story going? What happened to this guy? Well, today he teaches at university. He went on to get a PhD. It's an unbelievable story.
In what?
So in 2002, after he basically... got in touch with family, got his life back together, gave up the alcohol. So the first thing he did, I can't touch alcohol if I want to fix my life.
Yeah, please don't tell me you got a PhD in chemistry.
But the first thing he does is he enrolls in TAFE. And TAFE is one of the...
it's like a community college.
It's like
isn't
a
it?
Community college for Australia, right? So he enrolls in TAFE. And by 2008, he had graduated from Southern Cross University with a social science degree. He majored in sociology. And the reason he majored in that is he wanted to understand why he hated society so much. He wanted to really understand himself.
Well, after you've been abused that badly as a child, you can't blame someone for hating society.
Well, he started doing research for an assignment and he came across this 2004 Senate report on forgotten Australians. And this government report detailed the physical, sexual, and psychological abuse that was estimated to have been suffered by up to 500,000 children in out-of-home care throughout the 20th century. Mm. So just, you know, horrible orphanage situations. And he was stunned because he realized that's what happened to me. That's my story. So he started to work on his thesis. And for his thesis, he interviewed other people like him who had been through the same St. Patrick's orphanage, who had gone through the same experience. He received first-class honors. He went on to gain a PhD. It was only when he started teaching at the university, when he was, you know, in his office near his other PhD supervisors, that he actually stopped believing he was a sociopath. Because this was always this thing that was hanging wrong over his head since he was 16 years old.
Yep.
Is the expert told me I was a sociopath, that I was broken. And it took him his entire life and living in the wilderness, eating bugs and talking to aliens and his ancestors.
Drinking hooch.
To finally figure out that I'm not a sociopath. I just need to take control of my life. And he ultimately did. So just...
It's a really positive story at the end, though, isn't it?
Incredible story. Yeah. I'll link to the full video in the show notes. It's a nice kind of 15-minute video if you want to watch his whole thing. But I thought there's got to be more eccentric people like this out there. I also found this old article I'll link to in the show notes by Peter Davis. He had a weird story. He fled to the wilderness in 1987 because he was young. He was only 19 years old and he had been diagnosed with HIV. Mm-hmm. And in the late 80s, it was such a stigma. Like it's
a terrible stigma.
No one would want to go near you. No one really understood it. So he fled and he went and, you know, lived in the forest, basically climbed a mountain and lived in the forest. He came across this old mining hut that had been abandoned for 100 years and he lived there for a couple of years. But what was weird about his story, and again, there's a whole long kind of heart-wrenching story from him I'll link to. But what I found really intriguing is while he was on this mountain, he would occasionally see other hermits, you know, and he kept recognizing them as the same individuals because he said they always had the same outfit on. They wore the same clothes.
Yeah.
But he had this really weird detail because he wasn't fully, you know, crossed over onto, you know, hermit lifestyle. Like this is my life for the rest of eternity. He basically still wanted to talk to people. So when he would see these hermits, he would actually start walking on the track behind them. And he said he got pretty close, like, he would see one maybe 100 meters away and he would start following them to kind of see where they were going or to have a chat with them. But he said every time he got close to them, they would kind of turn a corner or go around a bend and he would quickly try and catch up so he didn't lose sight of them and they'd be gone. Every time this happened, it's like they just vanished, these guys. And I just found that intriguing because it reminds me of the Mount Shasta stories of seeing these people in white robes suddenly appear on the mountain and then disappear.
Well, are they actually people or are they, you know, like forest guardians that you hear of?
Well, he could never really get that close to tell. Another man he saw just emerged out of nowhere as he was coming down the mountain.
You mean like materialized?
He just came out of the forest and he doesn't give details on how he emerged out of nowhere, but that's what it felt like. Suddenly he was just there. But he said this guy was wearing a perfectly neat outfit. He had like a leather cap on and he had like a really neat vest and kind of old fashioned clothes. And he just thought, we're in the middle of nowhere. How are you so neatly dressed? Like those stories we've been covering recently.
Yeah, like a time slip kind of thing.
Of this guy with perfect polished shoes in the middle of the forest. But this guy was similar. He just looked so neat and he looked together, you know, he was groomed. And he says to him, oh, where are you from? Where are you going? He says, oh, I'm just going down for supplies. He says, well, where do you live? He says, oh, I live on the other side of the mountain in a tent. I'm a hermit.
But you're dressed in your Sunday best?
But that's the thing. Some hermits don't have their shit together and they just eat worms all day. Some hermits, like they look like they've just stepped out of an Armani store.
Yeah.
They've got their shit together. Imagine his tent. You probably go in there. It's like the TARDIS. There's like animal skins everywhere. There's a nice roaring fire going. It's probably beautiful in there. So
probably
that was
like
funny.
The Flintstones.
And I found this story amusing because of all the virus stuff, my parents have actually fled South Australia and they're living with me now here in our place in Queensland. And dad's, you know, really into his fitness. He goes on jogs every day around where we live. And where we live is quite rural here on the Sunshine Coast. And the other day, my wife, Teresa, went with him and they went for a jog just around our area. And he said it was just kind of up from our house where it's just basically forest on one side of the road. And they're kind of just lightly jogging along, my wife and my dad. And they just said, out of nowhere, this man just emerged from the forest. Like,
you mean because it's like national park there?
Yeah, like he just, like it looked like he'd spent the night in the forest. And they said it was so scary because it wasn't like he was walking, like he's ambling after a party where he's had too much to drink and he's just kind of stumbling out of the forest. He was walking out of the forest like the T-1000 in Terminator 2. Like he was on a mission. And my wife was like, oh, and dad just basically looked at my wife and said, run, just run. So my dad and my wife, they're running down the street. This isn't in the wilderness. This is down from my house. They're running down the street while this lumberjack Terminator has come out of the forest. They said they turned around. They got about 15 meters ahead and he was coming after them, but like walking really fast. So they just kept running and they eventually just came home.
He's probably a lovely guy. They were probably didn't realize. Like, but I get it. I get it why it's terrifying when you encounter something.
It was
like that.
Really strange.
So, because there's no tracks up there or anything either. So it's not like he's wandered off a track.
It's not like
he's just out of the bush.
It's not a walking track. He just came out of the forest. My dad said he had cobwebs on his flannelette shirt and he had this big bushy beard.
So you know what's going to happen, Ben? You're going to wake up tomorrow morning, you're going to look at your phone and there's a photograph of you sleeping.
Yeah, just butt naked. So yeah, please don't murder us, random guy that lives in the forest down from my house.
You actually need to, I think you need to look into that in more detail. You need to just go for a wander past and see if you see him, because that is odd. That's really strange, because there's no reason why you would be up there. I mean, unless you actually live there, there's no reason for you being there.
I reckon my wife and my dad could probably take him on.
Yeah, well,
they could take him.
They did run.
So there's another story of Jimmy the Possum in Mildura, and I found this old article from August of 1982 where he had died. And this was a hermit who had apparently touched the lives of hundreds of people. Because nearly 200 people showed up to this guy's funeral, Jimmy the Possum. And you would think to yourself, why would a hermit have 200 people show up? Like, how could he know 200 people? So the journalist covering the story was basically saying that most of the people didn't know Jimmy the Possum, but he found some people who had conversations with him and basically got the story of who this guy was. Basically, at some stage before or during the Great Depression, Jimmy was a jobless sheep shearer and he applied for what was known at the time as walkabout money. It was basically a stipend from the government that would allow you to travel from one sheep shearing shed to the next.
Oh, okay. So it's like a nomadic kind of payment.
Because it's the Aussie outback and they're so far apart, you know, it's there's not much work.
Yeah.
So you would get this government stipend to keep the work going. But apparently he was knocked back. He didn't get it for some reason. And he was apparently so deeply offended. He was like, no, I'm done with society. And he just walked into the forest and he lived in the wilderness for 52 years before he died. He never entered society again.
But then how did he interact with 200 people?
Okay, so this is the thing. He would always be close to towns, right? He would live in the wilderness, but he would occasionally come into towns. And The stories about the guy was that he was just incredibly virtuous.
Oh.
He would always help people no matter how it would affect him, or he would just do whatever he could to help people. So, for example, if he came across an animal that was in help, like a farmer's sheep, he would just shear it, take care of it, fix it up. There's a story of how whenever he would go past a property, if he saw a dog chained up, he couldn't stand it, so he would always let the dogs free, right?
Oh, what a good man.
Well, you might think, well, letting a dog free that's on a chain might be really annoying for the farmer that owns the dog, but here's the interesting thing about Jimmy the Possum and why everyone that he, you know, ever interacted with just fell in love with the guy. He had this firm sense of honor, so anything he would do, he would counterbalance it so that it was just. So if he let the dog go free, he would fix the farmer's fence. Like,
oh, I see. So the dog can run around, but not escaped.
Yeah, or if he went past your vegetable patch and he took three carrots to eat, he would fix a hole in your roof.
Mm.
And no one, people wouldn't necessarily know he had done this. They would figure it out later. They'll be like, oh, why is that thing fixed? Oh, it must have been Jimmy the possum because I'm missing a pumpkin from my vegetable patch. So he just had this sense of nothing was free. He always made sure that he paid in some way for whatever he took. And this philosophy went to the extreme because one year the Wentworth police, they wanted to basically help the guy. So they ended up arresting him under the vagrancy law. Now you might think, well, how is arresting him helping him? Their reasoning was that if we can bring him in, we can kind of get him to apply for the pension and then he can have a better life.
Surely he knows about that, so he wouldn't be interested. It's kind of like forcing someone to live a life they don't want to live.
Well, he had been in court three times that they'd tried this, right? And at this point, the magistrate urged him to apply for the pension, even offered to get the papers that very second and help him fill it out. But he refused.
Good on him.
Jimmy the possum said no. And the verdict was 3 months jail. They actually threw him in jail. And as soon as he got released, he went straight back out into the bush and never came near a town again. Now, the journalist spoke to someone who kind of had conversations with the guy and knew him. The reason he refused the pension was that he had never paid taxes. So his reasoning was he wasn't entitled to something for nothing. So he believed that principle so strongly, he went to jail for it. And I thought, that was amazing.
Yeah, that is amazing.
So Peter Head, who's 18, and in this story, they're saying he lived at this homestead and, you know, out in the wilderness. That's actually where Jimmy the possum was found dead. But when they interviewed this guy who owned the homestead, he said, I actually got to talk to him, you know, a few weeks before he died. And the guy was really intelligent. He wasn't insane. He just
had enough.
Didn't want to participate in society. And he stuck to these principles no matter what. Like, society wouldn't sway his principles. So I found that really cool. He was a good character. But my final stop on this search was the National Library of Australia. They have online scans of all these old newspapers going back to the 1800s. And the amazing thing about it is it's all searchable. Everything's been digitized. So you can just go in and search Wild Man, for example, and you get all these stories and newspaper clippings going back to like 1870.
Mm. Yeah, it's a great resource.
Wild men in the bush. So I started finding all these stories. This one was from the Goulburn Post in July of 1912. It occurred on a Wednesday. And this eccentric man has been making his presence a grave matter of anxiety and fear, especially to the women in the district.
Oh, no.
A fortnight ago, he was roaming in the vicinity of Gallimont, and news has come to hand that he has been run down by Constable McLean. They found him on the mountain, apparently. But when they found the man, he was making a whining noise like a dingo. He had no swag, no sleeping bag or food. His hair and beard was very long, which gives him a grisly and wild appearance. And when approached by the police, he was carrying a mallet stick with a large knob on the end of it. He appeared wiry and nimble and crossed the rocks like a wallaby. And they eventually captured him and, you know, put him in jail, basically. But there's tons of these stories. Oh, he was gibbering in German as well. So there's a ton of these stories where wild men are captured by the police.
It's all in German?
They're usually Italians or Germans. No, I honestly just found this was a trend. It's like they came, you know, to start a new life.
Yeah.
No, this is 1912.
Oh.
Maybe they came for the gold rush or something.
Oh, possibly, yeah. Well, when was the gold rush? The gold rush was 1880s, wasn't it? 1890s.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. They came for the gold rush. They didn't find any gold. And then because they didn't have any money, they couldn't get back home. And because all they could speak was German and English mumbling.
Yeah, they wandered out into the wilderness.
They had
the forest.
No prospects. So they went and lived and became wallabies. So there's a ton. I found another of an Italian guy who he just kind of wandered out of the forest speaking Italian, like giant beard, you know, a loincloth, just yelling in Italian at the police. There's a ton of them. But as you search through these, There's stories where you start to realize they've been called wild men, but it's in an entirely different category. So there was one from the Wagga Express in June of 1909. There was a peculiar scare around the neighborhood of Maitland Bar. Strange noises of a weird character were frequently heard, but what is tonight to be an explanation is contained in the following report. So it's basically about two youths named Summerfield and Lou. They're chopping down trees in the hinterlands, and they said they looked upwards after hearing a strange noise and describe a hairy man sitting at a rock staring at them. So immediately they're freaked out, they run, and they're pursued by this strange hairy man. They tell the story of how Lou fell into the river and the other guy had to save him. But basically, they made it back to their homestead. And this strange man, with it describes his weird lumbering gait, tried to open the door that they had barred. And he couldn't figure out how to open the door. He's like, and then he basically disappeared back up into the hills and was never seen again.
So are they suggesting that it's a human or a non-human?
Mrs. Brennan confirmed the boy's statements regarding the appearance of this stranger. He had long black hair covering his entire body. A search party afterwards scoured the hills but saw no trace. The district is very mountainous and there are plenty of hiding places. So there's a bunch of these where it describes footprints left behind that seem overly large, again, hair covering the body completely. A lot of the descriptions are of a large, bulky, huge, wild man. So you start to realize that even though they're in the same category, we're now talking about Yowies. Yeah. We're talking about Bigfoot.
Yeah.
But then there's this really weird one from May of 1932 from the Berrima Press. And it was a residence of Fitzroy near Mittagong, which is near where I grew up, have been worried by the sudden nocturnal appearance and disappearance of a strange wild man of the bush who wore some kind of bag-like contrivance on his head. This man left various camps in the neighborhood. He wrote warnings on buildings and crawled on all fours at times through the scrub. And after many fruitless searches, the police arrested the man, who was charged with unlawfully discharging a gun, and remanded. So there's a story about this fugitive, again, covered in hair, like really hairy, really bulky. I so desperately wanted this to be a Bigfoot one.
It wasn't, was it?
Because the bag-like contrivance they found on his head was a Ku Klux Klan hood.
Oh.
So just,
what an idiot.
But it's the way they paint the picture, it's so funny because he basically was wearing nothing. Like, he had no possessions. He had, like, torn shorts and no shoes, no shirt or anything, but he had a KKK hat. So he's
where
out.
Where do you even get one of those?
I know, it's bizarre. He's out there in the forest. And again, if it was Bigfoot, this would just be the perfect story. Bigfoot's out there doing his solo KKK rally in the forest.
You know what, with Bigfoot, I'm not surprised. I'm disgusted, but I'm not surprised.
Yeah, there's a ton of ones of nude men covered in hair, leaping incredible heights. I'll link to some of these in the show notes, but one of my favorite was from December of 1894. It was in the Wagga Wagga Press, and it was October the 3rd, actually, that this occurred. It's the story of this young Johnny M. Williams. He was riding from his home at Snowball. About halfway home, the boy was startled by a gorilla. This is according to the paper. The boy states that the wild man suddenly appeared from behind a tree about 30 yards from the road, stood looking at him for a few seconds, and then turned and ran for the wooded hill a mile or so away. Now, it's funny because it describes this animal running 200 yards away, and the kid's just staring at it, like, you know, it gives him plenty of time to look at this creature. But he starts describing it. He says it was well over 6 foot, heavily built. He just described it as a big man covered with long hair. It didn't run very fast, but he said it tore up the dust with its nails. But get this detail. While the creature was running away, it kept turning to look at the boy to kind of see if he was still watching. And it got to a log before the kind of main wooded hill. And the creature tried to jump the log. But it says in the report, it stubbed its toe on the log. And he said the creature had to keep running, but it was holding its toe. And it actually says in this 1800s report, it bellowed like a bullock as it tried to hop into the hills. So there's this Bigfoot has just gone, smashed his big toe on a log while his kid's just like, what is going on? And with this report, there was more backup sightings with people, trappers describing enormous tracks and, you know, hair samples. So again,
there's
just
something weird out there.
It's just a reminder, you know, if you couple this with hyenas and black panthers and weird structures in the forest, people going missing, that these final stories are just a reminder that the Sasquatch is a global thing, and Australia probably still has them out there in their wilderness. And again, I know we always talk about what could be the answer to missing 411, but I wonder if there's just some Sasquatch who don't take too kindly to people hiking out into their territory.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really simple answer, but and if you add the interdimensional element, that's why we don't find the bodies, or the bodies come back 4 days later, you know, and then it's finished.
Unless it's the Button Man.
I don't think it's the Button Man, but I mean, it's rather ominous the way that they've called him the Button Man. I mean, it seems like, oh, it's all friendly, but no.
Button Man's like a mafia hitman. Isn't that if you Google Button Man, that's the most returned response, is that Button Man is traditionally a mafia hitman position or hitman nickname. So it's kind of like...
you don't want to wake up and find him in your tent.
Yeah. That's a wrap for this show. Let us know if you've had any weird wilderness stories or strange, you know, camping encounters. Thanks to everyone on Twitter who keeps sending me these stories too. This was from Dick's Pizza, the link to the Age story. You'll find all that in the show notes again, mysteriousuniverse.org. That's a wrap for this Plus show. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being on Plus, and we'll catch you on Friday for your next MU. See you then.